Lucy Baxter, I'm Head of Industry at the Festival. And today we've got a very timely panel about investigative journalism on the island of Ireland. We will have a Q&A at the end, for about 20 minutes, so have a think about any questions or contributions you might want to make. I'm just going to hand over to our chair, Susan, now. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Lucy. Is this on? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Welcome everybody to this, I think, very, as Lucy says, timely and important conversation. It's probably most of you here know, but just to remind you, we're having this conversation in a context where a young journalist called Blair McKee was murdered in the streets of my hometown Derry just 5 or 6, 7 or 8, a few weeks ago anyway. And, you know, we're still all, I think, reeling from that. We're also coming to terms with the fact that we've just had two journalists who spent 9 months on police bail for having done nothing other than making an excellent documentary film. And we have the director of that film with us today, as well as one of the people who was arrested. So this is the context in which we're having this conversation. Somebody has died, people have been arrested. We have a situation where the whole role of journalism has been called into question. When the documentary No Stone Unturned came out a couple of years ago, I chaired a discussion at the Queen's Film Theatre about it, where the police ombudsman said that it can't be left to journalism alone to deal with the past of Northern Ireland, and that's clearly one of the contexts which we will be talking about today, because Sean Murray's film and Alex Gibney's films both are dealing with difficult and contentious legacy issues. So I'll just start by giving you a quote from Lord Chief Justice Sir Declan Morgan from the recent court case, which resulted in a victory for press freedom. He said that the journalists in the case had at all times behaved properly, that the police had not, that journalists' work is essential, especially in a society like ours, where confidence in the institutions is so important. And one of the barristers, Brian McDonald, who I see is present here today, talked about how, by contrast, the police had, in this case, conducted the kind of operation associated with a police state rather than a liberal democracy. So these are some of the contexts in which we will be talking today. And we have an absolutely brilliant panel of speakers. Barry's at the far end here. There. Barry McCaffrey is a multi-award-winning reporter. He started out in the Down Democrat in 1996, so it was natural that he would be interested in the Loughan Island atrocity, and he was obviously the ideal reporter to work on the film that ultimately was made on that atrocity. I know Barry very well, and I know him to be an encyclopedia of the kind of names, events and connections that no one in their right mind would want to have in their head, but he is incredibly generous with sharing his vast knowledge of the conflict here and indeed of the way that Northern Irish society works. He's a superb investigative journalist and he's very, very brave, and he has just been through a 9-month ordeal, which I think has probably shaken him very deeply, and as it has shaken the journalistic community, and we look forward to hearing about that from Barry. When every time that I was writing about the case, I found myself thinking about the first line of the trial by Franz Kafka, which goes, "Someone must have been telling lies about Joseph K, for he was arrested one morning without having done anything wrong." And I think that's the situation that Barry and Trevor found themselves in. Then we also have Sean Murray, which is a great privilege, because Sean has just brought out a film which has had an enormous audience response all over the place, Unquiet Graves. It's based on the book, by the very shocking book brought out a number of years ago by journalist turned human rights activist Anne Cadwallader. It's a book about the Glenan gang, a loyalist gang that murdered many, many Catholics during the course of the Troubles, and then which morphed into another generation of similar loyalists who have, you know, arguably are continuing to some degree right now. Sean made the film and brought it out, you know, raising a lot of the funds himself. He's a multi-award-winning filmmaker as well. He runs a company here in Belfast. He's won Royal Television Society awards for a number of programmes, and he's also worked on legacy issues, including Ballymurphy atrocity, which is currently in the courts as well here. So again, he will have a lot of experience to share in terms of getting work out there and the risks and fears that you would have in doing so. Then we have Catherine Johnson. Catherine, I've come to know quite well recently because we were both friends of Lyra McKee's. She's an author, broadcaster, freelance journalist and political activist. She's worked for most of the newspapers in Ireland and the UK, including the Sunday Times, the Daily Telegraph, the Times, the Irish Times, and she's broadcast on BBC and UTV and other things. She was also the co-author with her late husband of a book about Martin McGuinness. Her late husband was Liam Clark, of course, also a very distinguished journalist. And Catherine is involved in Amnesty and in the NUJ, so she'll be bringing the perspective as well, I think, of how the union can intervene to help to make, to keep journalists safe and to raise issues when they're not. We're going to start by looking at the... sorry, I forgot about Alex. Alex, sorry about that. Alex is kind of well known. He was described by Esquire magazine in 2010 as becoming one of the most important documentarists of our time, and that was before he made No Stone Unturned and several other really, really groundbreaking documentaries. He's a fearless director. He has written about, he's covered issues which people go to great lengths to stop you pursuing, and he has been relentless in his pursuit of them. He made a film about Scientology, which won 3 Emmys in 2015, and he made Mea Maxima Culpa, which was one of the really, really important documentaries about clerical abuse, and again it won 3 Emmy Awards. His Enron was nominated for an Academy Award, and then, of course, finally, or most recently, he has directed No Stone Unturned, on which he worked with Barry and Trevor. And he'll talk to us, I think, about, you know, not just making the film, but also the absolute dismay with which he must, as the director, have greeted what happened to his colleagues here in Ireland. So we're going to start off by looking at the two trailers for the two films produced by Alex and Sean, Unquiet Graves and No Stone Unturned. I'm not sure what sequence they're coming in, but we're going to watch those now, and then we're going to have a conversation, and then we're going to bring the audience into that. So thank you very much. So obviously both of those trailers indicate that both of these films are dealing with very chilling, very frightening and very disturbing material. So I think we'll talk to the two directors of the films first, and maybe yourself first, Alex. When you were drawn into this story by Trevor Burney, who had originally made a shorter film about Loughan Island, did you have a sense that, given the material, that it was potentially an unsafe area to be going into as a filmmaker?
Yes. I mean, there's a great danger in digging up the past, because the past is still present. It's something that we're all thinking about and still trying to reckon with and understand. And also, for me, I mean, I come from away, as they say in the state of Maine. You know, I also approached it oddly from a kind of an international context, in the sense that it's also about the state and how the state can become part of a, not only part of a crime, but part of a cover-up, and even worse, how the state manages the past by keeping secrets. That was something that was of great interest to me, and I know from the past and other films that when you challenge the state on that level, it can be extremely dangerous, not to mention the idea that, you know, here in Northern Ireland, you know, as you go from neighborhood to neighborhood, you know, there are a lot of sort of simmering passions still left below the surface. So for all those reasons, I reckon that there was some danger here.
And in the making of the film, did that... Well, I suppose maybe let's go to the situation which occurred after the film. Were you surprised when that happened, when you learned that Trevor and Barry had been arrested?
Yes, it was kind of a supreme irony. I was actually in Moscow, and I was within the context of, okay, I'm here, you know, I have a burner laptop and a burner phone, and I'm worried about, you know, surveillance and the intrusion of the state. And suddenly I got a text, I believe it was from Niall Murphy, you know, Barry and Trevor have been arrested, and arrested for allegedly stealing government documents. I was really shocked. And it had happened so long after the release of the film, so it seemed clear to me that it was a demonstration of power and an attempt within both a local context and I think also in terms of a broader international context of trying to send a message, not only directly to Barry and Trevor, but largely speaking to journalists and filmmakers around, stay away from investigations of the state.
Yeah. And obviously we saw, Sean, from your film that it's very much about the same territory, isn't it, and about investigating wrongdoing and violence that the state has been complicit in. Did you share a sense that this was dangerous territory? I mean, obviously you're from here, you live here, you know that it is a dangerous place.
I think whether a journalist or a filmmaker, if you're engaging in that type of work, there's always that threat. But yeah, I did feel it. I think it's different from where I come from. I come from West Belfast, and I think it's easier for me. And I've always said this at Q&As that I spoke at, it's much more difficult for someone like Trevor Burney, you know. Whereas where I come from, although it was challenging and we knew that it was a threat, it wasn't something that, you know, that put me off to a certain extent, you know.
And was there danger involved in making the film, do you think, at any level? I mean, we can talk about danger in a very broad sense here, I think.
I suppose that's subjective to how naive I am, you know, and I mean, at the end of 2017, actually, I received a death threat by making the film. It was on the same day as my brother did. He's the lawyer for the Balmurphy families. So they don't tell you, when the police come to tell you you've had a death threat, they don't tell you the reasons for the death threat, to just say that they've information that your life is under threat and you need to take these measures and these precautions. So we were, although it was publicised about my brother, I didn't want to publicise about myself because close connections to Queens. And actually a few days before I got the death threat, I was cycling through Sandy Row and had seen a loyalist. We both met eyes. Could have been that, I don't know, could have been something else, but it was something that I didn't want to really speak about at the time, you know.
And did it in any way deter you from proceeding with making the film?
It deterred me from stop cycling through Sandy Road.
Surprised you were still doing that at that stage, to be honest.
But I'd only began cycling through Sandy Road. It took me 40 years.
So, Catherine, maybe to turn to you now. I mean, you have experienced danger as a journalist, haven't you, in the course of your work? Do you want to talk about that?
Well, I'll talk about it very briefly. Is this microphone working okay?
Yeah.
Brilliant, thanks. I was arrested under the Official Secrets Act years ago for the heinous crime of revealing that Martin McGuinness's phone was tapped. And the big surprise about that was purely and simply that Tony Blair hadn't informed him. I mean, that is a very, very small example of the secret state and how everything, all information is controlled here. I've had threats. I don't know any journalist, frankly, working here for as long as I have who hasn't had the odd threat. It's par for the course. So Susan mentioned before, what could the NUJ do? Well, the NUJ is only as strong as the people who are in it and the people who support it. And we supported Barry and Trevor and Alex in the film, but we wouldn't have got very far without the international support and without the support from other trade unionists, filmmakers, journalists internationally. It was really, really moving.
Maybe then, before I ask you another question, Catherine, if we're going to talk about response to what happened to Barry and Trevor, we should turn to Barry at this point. And if you could just talk a wee bit, Barry, about, you know, what it was like to have that experience, because you're only just out the far side of it, aren't you? It was a 9 month process.
I don't know if we have the time yet to, you know, to download just where we are. We would spend time going here, there, and everywhere. We went all over America and UK and Ireland, and so we'd be driving along, and Trevor would probably be better speaking about this, but you go through those emotions. You know, you've got the anger, you've got the guilt, because you've got the guilt about what you're doing to your family. Trevor's children, obviously, had to watch him being arrested. My mother battled cancer. You feel as if the stress that you're putting, whether it's Sheila, Trevor's wife, or, you know, we were big enough and bold enough, we knew the risks that we were going through, or that we put ourselves through, but it was the stress and the hassle that you put your family through. That's the guilt. Have we changed? Will we ever be the same again? You know, I don't think we, without over dramatizing it, I don't think we probably will, because I think it's left this mark on us. And we were very lucky that I don't think we ever got any hassle, Trevor, did we? You know, on buying wing nuts on Twitter or whatever, but one particular person. But
let's not name
or his real name. But I think we, 99.9% of people were brilliant. I had a judge come up in the street, shaking your hand, and even the Trevor laughs about this on the day. I always thought they'd see the policeman and arrest me and bring the books me in. I thought it was him who thanked me. But Trevor read the statements again on Saturday, and it turns out that it's me thanks him. And but even then, it was only a small thing, but to me, it was a wee indication. He doesn't even think you're guilty. You know, he's shaking your hand and saying, "You're best of luck, keep your book." See if he thought you'd done something wrong, he wouldn't be shaking your hand. So, I forget what the question is, but no, we've done. I think our lives have changed. Yeah, is it the end of the world? No, Emma Rogan's lost a daddy. There's other people here lost way. Trevor laughs at this all the time. So does Susan. Susan says I'm worse than Bambi because we're not going to cry. We lost nothing. You know, ask Emma. Emma lost a daddy. Other people lost family members.
Well, I think that's something that yourself and Trevor were always very clear about throughout the thing, that whatever happens to journalists, you know, the big story in this is Loughlin Island, and it's the families from Loughlin Island, and it's great to see the support that they have given you in all of this, because, you know, journalists don't want to be the story, sure we don't, it's not really how it's meant to be. When you were making the film, Barry, did you have a sense of danger that you were dealing with material? I mean, you'd dealt with this material for years, you were probably one of the first journalists who recognised that there was something seriously wrong with what was going on in the aftermath of Loughlin Island. Did you have a sense when you were researching the film that you were getting into territory that was unsafe for you personally, as a journalist?
Yeah, I'm not going to tell the dog story, Trevor. There was two potential outcomes, possible outcomes. We could have been in touch with, we could have ended up getting death threats or physical attacks, and then the other possibility was the police thing. So on the 4th of November, the film comes out in October, the 4th of November, Steve Martin, ACC Steve Martin, releases the statement that, you know, the PSNI in Durham made the film, and as Trevor and myself has said, ad infinitum, George Hamilton had the choice to either look at the allegations in the film and go after the killers, but he chose to come after us. When the PSNI said announced that they were going to launch this investigation, I went to the Lord Mayor, John, my solicitor, and talked it through. What are the possibilities, John? What's going to happen here? Will they come and arrest me? Do I expect a knock on the door? And obviously, I'll just speak for myself, but as we all know here, the normal route is if you get a leaked document, if journalists have a leaked document, the normal police state response is they go to court and they get a production order. And the production order means you have to argue, you have to go to court, and a judge will decide whether you have to give it back or you can keep it, whether it's in the public interest. Now, they didn't do that in our case, and they've never explained why they didn't do that. What we do know now is on the 10th of August 2018, they go into a secret court, but they go into a court without our knowledge, and they apply, they ask the judge for a search warrant. Now, at that stage, the judge questions, well, why not go for a production order? What's different about these guys? And they say, no, can't trust these guys. These guys, they'll burn the evidence, they'll burn the notes. But what they don't tell the judge is that 6 months before the film was ever premiered, was that Trevor and Emer down there and John were, went and told the PSNI exactly what we were going to do. Told them everything, we were going to name suspects, and if the police had problems, they had the time to do that. Now, that's a crucial point in our whole case, because we believe that they deliberately withheld that key fact from the judge, because they knew, myself and Trevor believe, that they knew, the PSNI knew, that if they had told the judge that fact, they would have never got a search warrant. The judge would have said, well, sorry, these guys came and told you exactly what was going to happen. You can have a production order, but you're not arresting. And we believe, this is a crucial bit, we believe they deliberately misled the court, that they withheld vital evidence from the court. Now, the police board say they're going to have an inquiry and an investigation into what went on in our case. We believe that's the vital point. That's the key point. Did the PSNI deliberately mislead a court? Did they deliberately withhold vital evidence, key evidence, to secure our arrest? Because if they did, well, then we're in serious dips. This judicial system, the PSNI, the policing system, has serious questions to answer. Because if they are misleading a court, that's, George Hamilton, Mike Barton, senior police officers. Now, the problem is, they've all retired. They're all retiring. By the time these questions get to be answered, they'll all be away on their £1 million redundancies. We don't know, Trevor and myself don't know, whether these chief constables will be brought back to answer these questions. These are serious questions that, and it goes right to the heart of the justice system here. That's my rant finished.
Sorry. Thanks, Barry. Catherine, in terms of that case, obviously, it was a good judgment. We haven't got the written judgment yet, but we know that it's going to be supportive of the right of journalists to maintain the secrecy of their sources, and also it will be protective of whistleblowers who have the right to give information to journalists. Is that something that, do you think that will make Ireland a safer place, Northern Ireland, the UK, a safer place for journalists in itself?
I'll have to be honest, Susan, no, I don't. I think Alex mentioned the past, and I came all prepared to be very, very focused, which is not like me. and wrote out some quotes. And it struck me what Alex was saying about the past. The quote from George Orwell, 1984, and I have to read it out because I'd never get it right. Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. And I think it's all about power and control. And it's as Alex said, it's not just it's not just a crisis for journalism for truth. We're in the middle of an international political crisis. We've got Donald Trump. We've got the arrest of Julian Assange. I don't know where to stop. So I'm not going to go on. But I think the thing that I'd just like to mention something briefly about both films. Mm. I mean, they're both quite different in style, but one thing that they do share is conviction, commitment, and a poetic vision, which I think is one of the best and most important aspects of good, honest journalism. And I'd really like to pay tribute to all of the filmmakers involved. And I have to say, if you haven't seen Sean's film, it's worth watching for the very last sequence in it alone, where there's a graphic of Colin McCartney and Stephen Ray, who himself was... it was quite ironic, it adds another layer of meaning to it. Since Stephen Ray was a guy who did Gerry Adams' voiceovers during the media ban, it adds another layer to it. But Stephen Ray reads out the Colin McCartney poem.
Stand at Lochbeg.
And it's one of the most moving things I've seen in my life. And I really want to pay tribute to everyone concerned.
Thank you. Catherine was talking about the international dimension. Before we started, we were talking about what's happened in Australia since, and I think that there are other cases in America at the moment. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? I mean, the context of journalists coming under threat in other places as well.
Sure. I mean, I think that... let me riff on that and be a little circuitous, but I want to get it right to that point. I mean, the interesting thing about the Lachlan Island film, well, the rough irony of the Lachlan Island film is that we made a film meant to embarrass the police sufficiently so that they would actually investigate the murders that they never properly investigated in the first place. But instead, they found it far easier to investigate the journalists. I think that the recent decision was a really good decision. I think it was good news. And it's part of a longer ongoing struggle that is taking place here, but it's taking place internationally. And these battles have to be fought one at a time. I mean, recently, there was a Russian independent journalist, Ivan Golunov, excuse me for anybody who speaks Russian and how I butchered the pronunciation of his name, but arrested on drug charges recently. But there was such a hue and cry inside Russia, which is far more tightly controlled than here, that he was released and the charges are dropped. You know, so popular sentiment can play a big role in moving the system and also empowering journalists in ways that are good. Because honestly, journalists and filmmakers don't exist apart from society. They're part of a process in terms of holding the state and others to account. And so, you know, what's interesting to me about the law, and I'm not as cognizant about the laws here as I am in the United States, but, you know, very often what comes up is there a public interest defense, either in terms of the law or in terms of moral suasion. And that becomes a really big issue. And I know in the States, you know, in many instances, and the Assange case is an interesting one in that regard, there isn't really a public interest defense, but there is the idea that there can be or should be, and that to the extent that people stand up and really focus on that issue, I think the courts do hear it. and good decisions can come out. So I think that's a roundabout way of talking about this in terms of a broader international context. You're right that the case in Australia, for those of you who aren't familiar, is I believe it was a leak case also, and the government came down very hard on an entire newsroom. Again, it was a kind of a classic leak case, and it's far more chilling even than the case here with Trevor and Barry. But this idea of the public interest is terribly important. So that's to say that there's a role for all of us to play in terms of undergirding the importance of these principles of a free press and how we move to support them.
Yeah. And in terms of On Quiet Graves, Sean, I mean, did you feel that there was a resistance to what you were producing in that film? Like, have you found any resistance to it in authority circles, to that film being shown, to it being talked about, to it being funded in the first place?
Well, look, the resistance would always be with funding to begin with, because if you're becoming involved in a story like the Glen Ann story, or any story which would maybe cause controversy to the government, or highlight injustices with the government, it'll be very, very difficult to get funding. Now, I know that there was possible funding coming from NI Screen at the beginning of the process, but I think what happened was that 66 Days was released, and that after 66 Days there was a unionist backlash to the film around. And at a meeting afterwards, and I'd felt that, and I think that the people at NI Screen had felt that their jobs were under risk, and that they'd be very, very cautious, and then couldn't finance me. Now, it's understandable also, but it's not understandable that those pressures should be put on NI Screen. In a kind of way, I was happy, because as an independent filmmaker, we could go ahead then and raise the money without any constraints, which was, in the end, which worked out well for us. So we didn't need to worry about any institutions that were funding us, etc. But there were there was a number of things that happened along the way. I mean, I know that Queen's University was contacted a number of times, asking were they involved in this film. Basically trying to vilify me within the university, and also QFT, would they be screening the film, and that basically there's a film that would be coming out that would be propaganda. Were they financed? Was Queen's University involved in financing the film? So you had these external prizes that were happening all the time also. But I think we'd eventually get past all that, and it is a very, very important point to make, that although it's very, very difficult when you do make a film without institutional finance, it you can have something there that the vision that you wanted would, and the end product would be something you could be very, very proud of, you know, and not need to worry about.
Alex, you came under pressure from the BBC here to make changes to the film, didn't you? I mean, do you think that is a problem for journalists, isn't it? That if you will make something more anodyne, you are likely to have less barriers to it, but obviously it is less powerful and effective as investigative journalism. Was that a struggle that you had with the film, or was it just a clear-cut decision for you?
Yeah, it was a huge struggle. And for clarity, for those who don't know, I mean, you know, there was a long series of negotiations with the BBC, who were a minority funder in the film. The film was largely financed by Amazon, a globe-girdling corporation, which in many ways is pernicious, but also funds places like the Washington Post. But I knew that the film would be contentious here. And look, over time, there was a series of negotiations with the BBC about issues of right of reply and so forth and so on. And we were pretty careful. I mean, Trevor and Barry are experienced journalists working in this environment, and we were pretty assiduous about it. But there are a few key things, particularly in terms of the voices of the survivors of the atrocity and also how certain things would be described, that ultimately I didn't feel I could reckon with. That said, the deal with the BBC was clear, that we would make the changes that the BBC deemed proper, ultimately after negotiation, inside the UK territory. However, I had final cut of the worldwide version of the film, which I felt appropriate. And to me, that's the way to freedom. That is to say, sometimes you reckon with a broadcaster within a certain territory, but you have a version of the film that exists somewhere that you as a filmmaker or a journalist can then feel free to put out. And I said, I'm not going to give that up. The BBC was insisting that director's version of the film conform to what they wanted, including suggestions on how to write the commentary and so forth and so on. I would not agree. And on that basis, the BBC withdrew its funding and withdrew its support to the film. So, yeah, it's pernicious. But at the same time, I think the way to fight back is to be imaginative and how to figure out how to navigate. Now, ultimately, the film had a theatrical release here, not as as broad-based in terms of getting a big audience as a BBC broadcast would have been. Nevertheless, a lot of people went to the theaters, and the film became and is still very well known. So it got out, and it's still available, and people can stream it on Amazon. So the BBC negotiations were a problem, but I think that imaginative and journalists and filmmakers can figure out ways to make sure that larger media interests, which can be powerful impediments sometimes to the truth, don't crush them. That there are ways to find, particularly in the era of the internet, a way forward so that material can get out.
Would any of the rest of you like to comment on that? Just the whole business of getting difficult work that has controversial messages out in an environment like Northern Ireland? Is it something that's known to be problematic for journalism and filmmakers?
Well, I can't speak with filmmakers, but for journalists, you're always going to have that. Susan, you know, you're always going to have that. Catherine, you're always going to have that editorial battle. Listen, we're journalists, other people are editors. There's always going to be, and especially in issues like this, you find yourself going right to the edge, legally, morally, and everything else. And it's that relationship, that trust between a journalist and an editor. At the end of the day, it's the legal people who decide whether a story, what version of the story will be in a newspaper or on a film. Are we always pushing the envelope? Are we always trying to get closer and closer to the truth? Yes. Do we always get there? No. We don't. We have to be honest because of legal constraints and every other constraint. Is it frustrating? Yeah. But that's the world we live in.
Okay, I'd like to bring the audience in now because there's lots of people here who I'm sure would like to contribute. We have mics here for you, so if you do want to say something, would you wait till the mic comes, please? The man in front here.
Hello, my name is Michal Kat. I'm an investigative reporter from the Netherlands. I've been working in the south for 5 years. Now I came to Northern Ireland to report on the possible renewal of the troubles against, of course, the background of Brexit and the whole explosive political situation. It looks like this is maybe going to happen when you see what's happening to Lara McKee. It was already mentioned in Derry, the situation with the bombing, the bomb that was put on the car of the PSNI police officer just recently. So I'm studying very hard about to get to know everything about the troubles. This is another reason why I came, of course, to this venue here. But when you talk about the safety of journalists, I want to introduce a new element in the discussion which you don't hear so much about, and I think it's very important, and that's the European Union. Of course, Netherlands is a member of the European Union, just as Ireland is and United Kingdom still is. And in the recent months, we have seen four horrific killings of journalists, both in countries of the European Union. I think most people are aware of these situations. We had, of course, the Trouble-style horrific killing in Malta of the investigative journalists there, Daphne Caruana Galizia. We had killings in Slovakia, in Bulgaria. And I can also disclose that in the Netherlands, we had four killings of journalists. And this is one of the reasons why I left the country already many years ago. But talking about the European Union, all these journalists were, of course, killed in countries that are member of the European Union. And I have the feeling that the European Union plays a very negative, destructive role in this whole situation, because verbally, of course, they have they make a huge point of researching these events and then getting at the heart of the situation, but in reality, really never happens. Nothing really happens.
So could I ask you to be a wee bit quicker, because there's a lot of people probably watching.
My question is, if the panel sees also the importance of the European Union, because the name George Orwell was already mentioned, what we see happening is that a Orwellian European Union superstate is being created, which is also blacklisting journalists and which creates an environment which is really very, very detrimental to freedom of the press. They have all kind of commissions that combat fake news. I mean, of course, Ireland is also subject to, in the end, to the jurisdiction of the European courts. So I think this is an aspect that is often overlooked, and I would like to hear the opinion of the panel on this.
Okay, thank you. Take another couple of comments or questions. This man here, is there anybody else? Just stick your hand up so that we know where to go next with the mic.
Okay. Hi, I'm Phil Sprain and work at Queen's. One of the things I wanted to do was to, first of all, state absolute total respect for Trevor. And for my good friend Barry. I don't think anybody can imagine what it really feels like to be visited in the way in which they have been and the pressures that they've been put under. And I think that everybody in this room would agree that this is a step beyond which we would have expected at any time. And it's new ground. It's ground that has to be opposed as fully and as thoroughly as possible. What I wanted to say in the light of that was to kind of almost broaden the debate to talk about how critical analysis in our society here, but also more broadly, as we can see internationally, is being silenced, not only by the attack on press freedom, but also the concerted attack on academic freedom. Obviously, I don't work as a journalist, although I do a lot of work with journalists. I'm an academic, but I'm a critical academic. And what we've seen here is part of a process of an attack on critical thinking. We can see that with some of my colleagues in Queens and at Jordanstown, but also more broadly. It's an attack on academic integrity. And in that, it is about the use, actually, of the press to stifle academic freedom. And we've seen that here in the newsletter and also the Belfast Telegraph. I think the final thing that I wanted to say on this is that I know personally the price that can be paid for actually accessing those forms of documents that are absolutely crucial to a critical understanding of any major issue. And of course, people who know me know I'm talking about Hillsborough and the incredible amount of documents that we acquired over a period of time that I had no right to, and that were basically lifted documents. And isn't it interesting that those lifted documents have now paled into insignificance now that Hillsborough is seen as a great victory for truth and justice? Whereas you guys doing exactly the same thing on just a small element of those documents are held to account in a way which is completely unacceptable. So, I mean, if there is a question, I think the question is, how do we work together collectively? How do we lift it outside of the press, outside of the media more broadly, to include all of those of us who collectively are working towards acquiring the truth in some of the most contested and controversial circumstances?
Okay, thank you. Maybe take one more and then come back to the panel. As a feminist, it's disturbing me that we've had two men and no women, so are there any women in the audience who'd like to stick a hand up, say something? I'll leave it with you. Okay, so would any of the panel like to respond to either of the two speakers in the audience, both sort of making broad points, I think, about contexts as much as anything else? Barry, do you want to start?
Well, just when you talk about the European Union, I'm not talking about on a political level, but I'm talking about our defence was Article 10 of the European Convention, and that was our bedrock, and that is the bedrock of the defence of journalists, that we have a right to protect sources, we have a right to expose wrongdoing. When, for all the different problems that goes on with the European Union and everything else, are we going to be in a better position once Boris Johnson in the UK brings us out of the EU and we haven't got European Union protection? No, I think things are going to, very quickly for journalists, going to slide down a very dangerous slippery slope. Phil talks about how can we work together. You know, journalists, what George Hamilton and the police and the state have to realise is journalists aren't the problem. Journalists aren't the enemy. The police aren't the enemy. We, myself and Trevor, support policing. We support good policing. Nice, even it's bad policing, when it's unaccountable policing and when the police and the state are involved in the murder of its own citizens. Yes, well, that's when the state are involved in the murder of its own citizens, we're going to expose that. You're okay.
Sorry, could you just let Barry respond? We're going to speak for Barry.
Yes, that's good. But our people have to listen as well. And you can talk after. You'll be fine. So as Phil says, how can we work together? Well, journalists have to be allowed to do their jobs, same way as the police have to be allowed to do their jobs. When they break the law, if me and Trevor had broken the law, we deserve to get punished. Now, when the police or the state is involved in the murder of its own citizens, I believe that they deserve to be exposed. If journalists aren't, or the media and filmmakers aren't allowed to do their jobs, well then we're not really living in a democracy. And that's, you're okay, me and you should want to speak afterwards. Sean.
I just want to pick up on the point that you mentioned, Phil, about the attack on critical thinking. I have to say that the response when Barry and Trevor were arrested, right away, the response that I got from leading academics and major artists around Ireland right away, we got 400 people on the night, the same invitation right away. And then the following day, I'd seen how journalism, the whole movement in journalism, had came ahead of it also. I thought it was very, very good. And that, you know, it's fitting that you have mentioned the attack on academic thinking. Now we see it in the attacks on yourself and Colin Harvey, and maybe on Professor Brewer also at Queen's University. But I've been very, very moved at the response to the arrest, not only from journalists, but also from major artists, and I see a few in here tonight, and also leading academics. So I think, in many ways, there's positives that came out of your arrest, Trevor. But there has been, and I think you can situate that also within the whole middle ground movement that we're seeing recently, and that the extremism that we've been dealing with, whether it's the old guard within the RUC and the PSNI that are still there, or other elements of extremism, whether it comes from Republicans, say, or Unionists, say, I think that there has been a lot of positives that I've seen today, and it can be built upon. It was great to see it.
Catherine, do you want to comment on that?
Really just on what Phil said about, what was it, the attack on critical thinking. I think that's really hitting the nail on the head, and that's what we have to fight against, whether we're journalists or citizens, well, of course, all of us can be many things. Somebody quoted the Ombudsman earlier today saying that truth was too important. I think it was truth was too important to be left to journalists alone. I was at a conference at Queen's a couple of Fridays ago with John Brewer and Paul Gallagher of Weight of Victims Trauma. And there was no politicians there. I was not surprised, but, you know, at the same time I was bloody shocked. And I asked one question at the end. What would the panel say if there were any politicians there today? I mean, the response was unanimous. Peace is too important to be left to the politicians. And I think we all have to get involved. We all have to get engaged. We all have to debate and get involved in critical thinking. Or we're doomed to another 30 years of this situation. I mean, everybody talks about we're in a post-conflict situation. No, we are very, very far from that. We're in a post-ceasefire situation. And the sooner that we realise that and get to grips with talking to each other and examining the past, the better. And just one very, very last brief point. There was a woman, Cheryl Lowther, speaking at the conference, and she mentioned the Casa de la Memoria in Colombia about the victims. And I mean, it struck me that what they were doing was absolutely amazing. She talked about one exhibit which was composed of triangles and cubes, and you could rotate the photographs of the victims to put them beside other people to see different elements of their stories. And I mean, why can't we be moving towards something like that, where we recognise all victims instead of just playing about and being selective and binary about the way we see life here?
Alex, you're filling up an envelope here with very
incoherent notes. Yes. No, I also wanted to pick up on this idea of critical thinking, but and the role of journalists and filmmakers. I mean, look, you know, I live in a country where the president of the United States has branded the press the enemy of the people. And it's no accident. And you could see in the rallies running up to his election, Trump, you know, would call out members of the media and have the crowd scream at them as to isolate them. And, you know, so I do think that what's important here is not, that's an attempt by those in power to isolate journalists and or filmmakers, to put them in a box, to say they're not important, they're not relevant, they stand apart from society. And that indeed is what I think the PSNI did here with Trevor and Barry, to say, oh, they've broken the law, they're not a part of us, and to criminalize what, you know, to criminalize journalism or what it does, and indeed, the idea of stealing the secrets of the state. Well, the secrets of the state aren't owned by the state. They're owned by the people. That's the way it's supposed to work. So I guess the big note here is understanding that we're talking about the role of journalists and the press and the dangers. It's this sense of the public interest that everybody has to coalesce to understand and support that idea, but that everybody in a society is there to hold, you know, their governmental institutions to account. So support of the press is part of that, but critical thinking is a terribly important part of that too, because otherwise the only... think of a state in which there is no mechanism by which to hold it to account. You know, do we think that everybody will do the right thing? No. So that notion of how important the press is in, or the press, or the filmmakers, or speech, let's just call it speech, is in a society, is that's the issue. And that's an issue for all of us, not just the press.
Okay, thank you very much. Does anybody else in the audience like to ask a question or make a comment? We're supposed to finish up at 15:15, but I think it's we can go on for another few minutes if there's anything else anybody would like to say. So, oh, hooray, woman. Thank you.
I think I said this, I was at the London film festival Q&A you did for Mr. Milner. I think part of the problem we have to remember is that this has been treated very differently, say, from people investigating Hillsborough, because the British establishment, like, is really telling that David Davis, a Tory, turned up to support you. No other MP mentioned it. Nothing else was, you know, this happened in London and Liverpool and Leeds. There would be a completely different reaction, and I live in London, and I was like, don't normalise this stuff. And it's still very normalised. This is just Northern Ireland. It's like, it's very different. So if you have any comment to make about how, you know, just like the lack of coverage for these sorts of issues in Great Britain, you know, like the Australian arrests were on the front page of the BBC news website, the UK BBC news website, like, and you were on the front page of the BBC Northern Ireland one, but you weren't on the front page of one of, you know, the BBC UK one. So just in terms, you know, same thing with the abortion stuff, Georgia, Tennessee gets much more coverage than here, yes, even though it's the same country.
Trevor, would you mind if I ask you to perhaps respond to that in terms of the coverage that you got? Did you feel that you didn't, that there was a kind of an attitude that Northern Ireland is just this kind of slum where anything can happen and anything is to be expected? Or did you feel that you did get adequate coverage in the UK or elsewhere?
Sorry, repeat this, the last one.
Just, did you think that you got adequate coverage in the British press and wider, further afield perhaps?
I think that the British press largely ignored our list for several months. In fact, myself and Barry first appeared on BBC National Radio last Thursday.
Really?
It was the first time we'd been interviewed for the Today programme at 5 to 9 last Thursday morning, which was almost 10 months after our arrest. And yes, The Guardian covered the story periodically. Jim Watterson there took a personal interest in and was very supportive. But I think that also, we also got a look south of Dublin as well, and I think that the story was largely ignored in the mainstream Dublin press and in the broadcasters, because I think it is that what you're seeing is this basket case, and these things happen, and, you know, it's just too difficult to understand. It's not straightforward in Northern Ireland. And I think that was very difficult for myself and Barry, because we saw that as almost like an unstated criticism or some sort of comment on our culpability here. We really did feel, you know, I feel, beside Barry McDonald, you see, our one of our lawyers, along with the other two, Niall and John here, and they'll know that initially at the start, I felt that what had happened to us wouldn't happen in Britain or wouldn't happen in Dublin. I fully and absolutely believe that if myself and Barry were working inside the BBC as current affairs reporters making this film, the police would not have raided their offices and would not have downloaded their server in the same way they did to us. But for some reason, that they felt that we were fair game. And I think that wasn't understood by our journalistic colleagues in London or Dublin, not fully anyway. And I think that, you know, when the question here, are investigative journalists safe to work in Ireland? I think that what I felt after this experience is that the risk isn't really from the street. The risk to journalism in Ireland, particularly in Belfast, is from the state. And it really, only due to the checks and balances that we've seen as a result of a judicial review that we had to get up and running and on its feet, the police have decided to end the investigation into us. And the way that the court responded during the judicial review to the issues, I think that we've got to be thankful that the courts are independent, and certainly the court in our case acted so robustly in response to what was an attack on free speech, an attack on press freedom here in Belfast. So it's a long way around answering your question, and that I don't think that, I'm not sure if we were working inside a press or media organisation in London, this would have happened to us. And I do think that there was a distinct lack of interest in London and Dublin to what happened. which probably only really came to national prominence once Channel 4 News led with the story on the Friday that the warrants for the searches were quashed. And I think, you know, is it any wonder then that London fails to understand what the issues are with backstops and borders if they really don't feel that they need to get their head around the arrest of journalists in a part of the UK?
Yeah, I think that's very true, certainly of the Republic as well, where a majority of people are supposed to be currently interested in a united Ireland, but don't take an interest in the things that happen up here, really. I think we might end at that, because it is 4:15 now, unless is there one more question that somebody burningly wants to ask?
We've exhausted them.
Yeah. Okay, maybe just very, very, very quickly,
one,
please.
One very quick one, I will speak about it back too. Do you find
could you just,
it
could you just wait for the, there's a mic coming to you.
I mean, Callum kind of alluded to this. Do you find it unusual that there, apart from our Dutch friend here, you've had no critical voices here? You've had plenty of people trying to stop you, plenty of people trying to talk to Queen's, talk to the QFT, about why, talk to the BBC, about why is not money's being spent on your investigations, but nobody turns up here to query what you're doing?
Anybody want to respond to that?
Great. Well, this isn't Twitter. We usually do it on Twitter. I don't usually call up the events like this where there's a lot of critical thinkers.
Okay. I think there's a subtle undertone and a subtle threat. You know, people talk out of the sides of their mouths. The whole, for 10 months, all the PSNI did was brief political parties and you're going to be left wing. The Amnesty supported us. The other lots of international groups. We were all told by the police, you're going to be left wing on your face. We're going to do these guys. You've supported them, and you're going to be left holding the baby. Now they were the PSNI were the ones left holding the baby. As Trevor said, they didn't give up. They didn't abandon their investigation. They were forced to give it up, because Mal Murphy and John Finnegan and Brian McDonald taught them a lesson at the court, because they exposed the wrongdoing that they did. Did we get all the support journalistically from our journalistic colleagues here in Belfast and in Dublin and other places? We had great support from some people. There were other colleagues who didn't come out and bat for us at all. And I think they, if they can sleep at night, that's good for them. You know, I think they need to look at themselves. As Sean says, I think there's, you know, it's very subtle the way people try and stop you.
Okay.
So,
Alex, do you want
just
to...
very briefly, just in the case of Nostan, I will say to this gentleman's point, not just here but also during the release of the film, I was a bit surprised and disappointed, in a way, that there wasn't a more robust attempt to criticize the film on its own terms. You know, if there's something wrong with it, let's hear it. There was certainly pressure, an undercurrent of pressure that ultimately evolved into the arrest of Barry and Trevor. But where was that criticism, that upfront and open criticism, which on the one hand makes me feel good that maybe got it right, because it was very hard to criticize. But I wonder why that is, and whether some people are more comfortable exercising that critical voice in different ways.
Yeah, I mean, I do remember that when No Stone came out, it was quite some time before the BBC even mentioned it here, wasn't it? I mean, it was being talked about internationally before it made it onto one of the talk programmes on BBC Northern Ireland.
Well, and that, I think, was a clear case of embarrassment by the BBC. The BBC had dropped a film that, look, I'm prejudiced, but I think was a very good film, and was certainly important in terms of uncovering what had not yet been discovered, or at least revealed by the police in this horrific case. The BBC was embarrassed, and so their official posture was, we'll just ignore it, until they were forced not to.
Okay, thank you very much to all of our panel. Just give them a round of applause. very much for your attention and your very good questions. The Alex is taking part in another event later. Alex, what time is your event this evening? 6:45 this evening at the Odeon, if you want to hear Alex discussing his wider field of work. And the other thing that Lucy has asked me to mention is the further discussion on Friday at 3 called State of the Place with Bernadette McCloskey, Sophie Long, Paul Gosling and Una Mullally, and we'll be talking about post-Brexit Ireland. So that's another event to come to here in the museum. So thank you very much, everybody.